So wonderful to see you on Labor Day or the Labor Day weekend. So I thought for the talk today, I'd actually like to talk about, you know, labor, work, from the kind of from our the point of view of our tradition. It's quite interesting as I was doing a little bit of research and thinking about this. You know, this weekend, the Labor Day weekend, I think most of us really regard this as, you know, the kind of last days of summer, a kind of bittersweet reminder that summer is almost over and then the busyness of autumn is only a few days away. And if the weather cooperates, many go on picnics or have barbecues with friends, maybe squeeze in one more camping trip or a paddle on a lake or in the ocean. I think we have, you know, as a society, you know, kind of as a community, mostly forgotten the meaning and the intent of Labor Day. So here's a little history for some of us that may not really remember. In Canada, Labor Day, of course, is a federal statutory holiday celebrated on the first Monday of September. And its origins begin with a Toronto printers' strike in 1872. And at that time, most of the working class worked 12 hours a day, or more, and the printers' union was striking for a 9-hour a day with only working 54 hours a week rather than, you know, the usual 60 plus hours that workers often worked at that time. And this was followed by a number of other strikes around Canada, and workers rallied across from coast to coast. And then in 1894, the first Monday, September, became a statutory holiday in Canada in order to commemorate this movement to kind of help workers contain the tremendous amount of time they spent in labor. And of course, most of it was, you know, physical labor. And it used to be celebrated with parades, speeches, games, picnics, kind of large picnics, largely to kind of promote the working class solidarity. But by the 1950s, these activities more or less kind of died out. Although I do have a very vague memory of having some kind of outdoor event that my father took us to. He was an airplane mechanic and belonged to, you know, one of the unions. I don't know what union, but anyway, I remember going to this kind of outdoor event with hot dogs and can't remember too much else than that. But today, I think it's really more Labor Day is just a family holiday or a time perhaps to spend with friends. We don't think or regard work or think about our labor so much on Labor Day. And in fact, I think we kind of, as a group, struggle with kind of conflicting attitudes about work. The kind of remnants of the Protestant work ethic tell us that we should work, that work is important for our character and moral well-being. Work, then, as a virtue, or at least a means by which we can, you know, gain some kind of virtue. But in modern times, the moral virtue thought to be gained by work or by hard work and hard work for long hours. This moral virtue, I think, has largely been replaced by financial rewards. Climbing the social ladder, perhaps. And perhaps meeting group expectations. You know, you can't leave the office until the boss does or until everyone else does. And for many of us, meaning, justification, and purpose are all sought in career or occupation or professions. And yet, of course, for many, a stable career or profession is out of reach. And for most of those who labor at low-paying work jobs, like fast food restaurants or hotel cleaners, convenience store clerks, the work of these people goes largely unnoticed and largely not respected very much. I was reading a little bit about the history of work. And according to Marshall Salins, the author of Stone Age Economics, the traditional Kung people of the Kalahari worked for about 15 hours a week. The men hunted for roughly 2 hours a day, and the women gathered vegetables and prepared meals for roughly the same length of time. So, as you can imagine, there was plenty of time for naps, games, music, gossip, rituals, and also days off. Hours a week. On the other hand, the average Canadian, according to the latest statistics that I could find, works for 40 hours a week. But our smartphones, laptops keep many of us, of course, on call to our employers. And, of course, when one's primary job isn't enough, it's necessary to patch together another job or two to, you know, pay off student loans or maybe even just to meet the rent and food expenses. And if lucky, build up a little savings. Somewhere, as a society, we have taken a wrong turn. You know, there's so much more to say and talk about the kind of unfairness of our economic system, both in terms of spiritual, psychological, and maybe financial stress that we all experience. But let me shift a little bit and talk a little bit about what the Buddhist tradition says about work and how those teachings that we see within the Buddhist tradition may help us in our present situation. Views about work or labor in the Buddhist Sangha went through a kind of evolution. The monks and nuns of the Buddhist time, as I think most of us know, completely left the household life, along with its requirements for work. Lay people labored in the fields and did other things like that. But the Buddhist monastics, both male and female, adopted the lives of renunciates, which required them to live on donations from lay people, as was the custom in Indian society at that time. Monastics were forbidden from doing most kinds of labor. For example, they could not work at a garden or in farming because they might kill something. Nor could they carry money or engage in any kind of economic activities like trade. The monastics, their activities were limited to studying and teaching the Dharma, maybe cleaning and maintaining the temples or buildings that they stayed at. A meditation practice, of course. And begging for alms. Anyway, that's how it was in early times in India and still in some places today in Southeast Asia. However, Buddhism, when it took root in China, faced several challenges to this kind of renunciate way of life. Chinese culture, as Buddhism began to move into China, was of course based on Confucian teachings. And a very important Confucian value was placed on being a very productive member of society. Begging was frowned upon. And another challenge was that the northern Chinese climate was very cold, much colder than, of course, the climate in India. And monks and nuns needed to kind of congregate and more or less stay in monasteries rather than, say, living on the edge of a forest or wandering and living temporarily in various parks, as was the custom at the time of the Buddha in India. As Buddhism became established in China, Buddhist monastics of all kinds, of all schools, probably worked much more than their Indian ancestors. However, it was the Chan, or the Zen tradition, Chan being simply being the Chinese word for the Zen. So I'll use Zen since that's what the word most of us are familiar with. So it was in the Zen tradition that manual labor became strongly emphasized as a spiritual practice. And the famous Chan or Zen monk, Baijiang Huihai, who lived around kind of middle 700s to the beginning of the 800s in the Common Era. Baijiang is credited with compiling the first full set of Zen monastic regulations and practices. And even today, he is widely evoked as a source of religious authority or inspiration. And I would say remains perhaps one of our most honored Chinese ancestors. So this Zen or Chan monasticism includes periods of work that went far beyond the simple cleaning and cooking that maybe the Indian ancestors engaged in. It included farming, handling of money, which of course was not traditionally acceptable in Buddhist monasticism. But in China, it allowed the Zen communities to become self-sufficient, to prosper, and also to avoid being eradicated when there was great oppression against the Buddhist communities in China at various points in history. But at any rate, that's kind of enough of history and kind of academic stuff. Here's a story. You know, I'm so grateful to be part of the Zen tradition because we're full of stories. And what's better than a good story? Eh? So here's a story about Baijiang and work. Probably many of you have heard this one before, but I've got one or two other ones up my sleeve. So Baijiang was very insistent on working every day, even though he was the head of a large monastery, highly respected teacher in his day. And when he was old, maybe even as old as me, he insisted on this. And the monks felt sorry for him, so they hid his tools. And when the monks refused to tell Baijiang where his tools were, these were probably gardening tools, right? He said, "I have no virtue. Why should others work for me?" And he refused to eat. His monks kept entreating him to eat, but Baizhang replied, "A day of no work is a day of no eating." His monks then, realizing their error, returned his tools. Now, this saying fairly quickly became quite famous in Zen circles, and to this day, the Zen schools are noted for their emphasis on work and the making work as a spiritual practice. I really like this story, and because it tells us about a greater understanding of work. Baizhang saw work as intimate with the human condition. And as the Zen school, you know, spread throughout China, it firmly embraced the teaching that work or labor expresses the very fullness of one's life. It's not just to get something done. It's not just to get something made. In a piece of writing called Tenzo Kyokun, Instructions to the Cook, written by Dogen, the Japanese monk who first went to China to bring Zen practice, or this style of Zen practice from China back to Japan. And Dogen lived in the 1200s. Anyway, in the Tenzo Kyokun, Dogen tells the story of an encounter he had with the Chinese Tenzo, or head cook of a monastery. So Dogen had sailed from Japan and was still on the ship in a Chinese port when he met this Chinese Tenzo, or this Chinese head cook. The Tenzo was quite elderly and had just walked a long distance from his monastery in order to buy mushrooms from the Japanese merchants on the ship that had come from Japan. And Dogen asked this Chinese monk to stay longer so they could talk about Buddhism. Right, first Chinese Buddhist monk Dogen met, probably. But the Chinese monk said he had to leave right away to get back in time to prepare for the next day's meal. And Dogen was a little bit puzzled, and he said this to the Chinese monk, "Why, when you are so old, do you do the hard work of a Tenzo? Why do you not spend your time practicing Zazen or working on the koans of former teachers? Is there something special to be gained from the work as a Tenzo?" And the Tenzo burst out laughing when he heard Dogen say this and remarked, "My good friend from abroad, you do not yet understand what practice is all about, nor do you understand the meaning of characters." Meaning the writings themselves. You don't understand what the Zen writings are telling us. After describing this exchange, Dogen writes, "When I heard this old monk's words, I was taken aback and felt greatly ashamed." Perhaps at that moment, Dogen realized he habitually separated work from his spiritual practice, seeing one as profane and the other as sacred. Perhaps he came to see the emphasis on his study of religious texts or formal Zen practice, that the emphasis perhaps was misplaced. After all, the opening lines of the Xin Xin Ming, one of the earliest and most influential Zen Buddhist texts, and one that Dogen would have known very, very well. The opening line of this poem goes, "The great matter is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised." these old ancestors, eh? Here's another story about Baijiang. So once Yunyan, another famous monk, became a teacher, asked Baijiang, every day there's hard work to do. Who do you do it for? And Baijiang said, there is someone who requires it. And Yunyan replied, why do you not have him do it himself? And Baijiang said, he has no tools. So here, Baijiang is telling us about our intimacy with the world. There are, of course, many kinds of labor or work. Keeping alive requires work, right? Preparing food, cleaning, keeping warm. There's work for our livelihood, work to raise children, work to care for a parent, a spouse, a friend. Our typical view is that we have times when we work and times when we have leisure and times when we have spiritual practice, etc. But from the Zen point of view, that's not quite right. Our practice is to meet each moment fully. Sometimes we are active, sometimes we rest. But rather than saying work time, leisure time, there's just life, the meeting of life at this moment. Each moment we meet mindfully, we meet with dignity. Our labor, our work in the Zen tradition is not primarily to finish a task or to meet a goal, but rather it becomes continuous practice, to use a phrase Dogen created. So let me just read you a little quote about this idea of continuous practice. This is from Dogen. Continuous practice is undivided, it not forced by you or others. The power of this continuous practice confirms you as well as others. It means that your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although not noticed by others or by yourself, it is so. Accordingly, by the continuous practice of all Buddhas and ancestors, your practice is actualized and your great road opens up. Let me just pick a couple of lines from that. It continues practice, right? It means your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although not noticed by others or by yourself, it is so. I think here Dogen encourages us to labor as an offering, to work as an offering to the world, as a gift to all beings. And although you may not be aware of it, your actions touch everywhere, and everywhere touches you. The whole sky, the whole earth in the 10 directions. Dogen tells us that all activity as practice, when we take that up, all activity as practice is saturated with Dharma and expresses Buddha nature. And this is the foundation of our life. So let's go back to that exchange for a moment between Yunyan and Baijiang. Every day there's hard work to do. Who do you do it for? Baijiang replies, there is someone who requires it. Yunyan said, why not have him do it himself? And Baijiang said, he has no tools. What a powerful question. Who requires our hard work? On one level, we might say, I need it. or our friend, spouse, or family. But on another level, life itself calls us to offer ourselves. Life itself calls us to offer ourselves. Perhaps it does, but maybe that's not quite right either. We are tools. Our hands, legs, ears, our whole body, our minds, of course, are the very tools for life to express herself, are the very tools for life to actualize herself. Baijiang tells us that in this sense, he does not work to make a living, to get as much done as possible or to be promoted, but out of love that arises for the job itself, the love for someone who requires it. I think the effort, when we enter into work like this, is rich. And when we enter into work like this, the mind is free. Our heart is free of kind of critical, restricting thoughts. Perhaps we could say, we are born into this world to labor. We're born into this world to give birth to life itself. Practice as life. Life as practice. So earlier I talked about, you know, the kind of economic, spiritual, and psychological issues that we all face in this unfair system. So how do we bring a mindful, joyous, and caring way of work into this 24/7 world of ours? I think it is our task, each of us, to find ways to bring life into our work and to bring our work to life. On this Labor Day weekend, I hope we can all resolve to enliven the work that we do. All the work that we do. And in our tradition, there are many ways to bring mindfulness and awareness, of course, into our life and into our work. And I encourage you to experiment and try different strategies. But here are four practices to help us with this resolve to enliven our work. In the Zen tradition, I'll just talk about them quickly. In the Zen tradition, gathas, or short verses, are memorized and used before entering into everyday tasks. So if you spend time at a Zen monastery, there's a gatha before you enter the bath, before you brush your teeth, etc. But here are some. And these ones are ones from Robert Aiken Roshi, who was one of the first non-Chinese Zen teachers to bring this tradition from Asia to the West. So he created these gathas. Waking up in the morning, I vow with all beings to listen to those whom I love, especially to the things they don't say. Walking my baby at night, I vow with all beings to give rest in space and time and a chance to my child and all children. Whenever the telephone rings, I vow with all beings to allow it to ring one more time as I carefully breathe in. When the traffic is bumper to bumper, I vow with all beings to move when the world starts moving, and rest when it pauses again. And one more, not from Robert Aiken, but I thought it was kind of nice. Washing the dishes is like bathing a baby Buddha. Everyday mind is Buddha mind. So a second practice, especially if we're doing physical labor, is to bring awareness to the hands as they do the task, or the body as it moves around the office at home. Norman Fisher, the teacher who ordained Kate and me, said one of his mindfulness practices was to bring awareness to his body every time he passed through a doorway, pausing for a moment, taking a breath. So you can experiment and play with some way that you may bring mindfulness to your body throughout the day. And the third suggestion is to offer whatever benefits may arise before or after you do your work. On our full moon ceremony, the final dedication has the line that goes like this. Thus, on this full moon night, we offer the merit of the Bodhisattva way through every world system to the unconditioned nature of all being. In a similar way, using language that really resonates for you, you can offer the merit of your labors before or after you begin, to the healing of the world, to those who you know who are ill, to the homeless, the dispossessed, to whoever or whatever is in your heart at that present moment. And a final suggestion, and a pretty common one, I guess, is just to pause in the middle of your task, especially if you're working on a computer. Breathing in a couple of times, bringing your mind to something you're grateful for. Perhaps that cup of coffee you had at breakfast, the view that's out your window, the dear friend you're going to meet later. And then with that sense of gratitude still present, return to your task. I'm sure you'll have many more ideas of possibilities to bring life to your work and bring your work to life. But I'd like to end by giving the final word to our Chinese ancestor Baijiang again. One more story. One day, Baijiang, addressing his assembly, said, "Plow the rice field for me, and I'll instruct you in the fundamental principles of the great matter." After the monastics had plowed the rice field, and at this time in China, monasteries often did have land that they would, of course, cultivate for themselves. After the monastics had plowed a rice field for the master, they said, "Now, master, please instruct us in the fundamental principles of the great matter." Baijiang then spread wide his arms. That's the end of the story. Maybe you're puzzled. What does he mean? Maybe you think, oh, I get that one. But it's okay not to really know. In fact, I hope you leave scratching your head over all these stories that I've told you. because it's important to not know about our work. Important to keep coming back to explore it with great depth. Here's a poem to close on. One of my favorites by Wendell Berry, the American poet. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. Thank you so much for coming today on Labor Day. I wish you all beautiful rest and deep, insightful labor.